Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank?
I'm great, my young Padawan. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now, you have a special guest this week, potentially, who may or may not make an appearance on the podcast that we should warn listeners about.
I do. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but my son got a puppy within the past 6 months.
Okay, good.
Yep, and it is a, as I said, a six-month-old Cavapoo named Bella, and she is staying with us at the moment because my son is away on vacation or holiday with his girlfriend, and so she's been with us for the past 4 or 5 days and will be with us for another couple, and she doesn't usually bark, and she's napping right now, but if somebody comes to the door, we often get the mail at this time of day. You may hear some background noise.
All right. So listeners, if there is a interruption, that is Bella making herself known.
Right? You have met her, Dave.
I have met her multiple times, and yes. She is an extraordinarily cute little dog.
Yes, but it does bring me back to the times of having little beings around the house that I'm responsible for.
Quite a responsibility, Frank. All right.
Yes, good. Well, I'm managing.
So we are now 76 days until the election. We are 6 months into a pandemic, 3 months into an economic crisis. We've got the census going on. We've got a post office crisis. We've got the Black Lives Matter movement continuing in full force and 12 other things dominating the news.
Well, Joe Biden was nominated last night formally.
Yes. Okay. So that's above the fold today, but who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, right? And so there's a really interesting article about how historians process all this, or at least how one historian processes all this, by our friend Joanne Freeman in The Atlantic. And it's in a piece entitled, "I'm a Historian, I See Reason to Fear and to Hope." So I thought we'd use that article as a sort of a way for talking about how historians sort of process all the things that are going on right now and how we make sense of this particular chaotic and obviously historic time we're in, where things are moving in unpredictable and chaotic ways and are tied together in ways where I'm not sure we all fully understand. Frank, what's your original initial take on Joanne's article?
Well, I enjoyed it a lot, and as you say, Joanne is a friend of the pod, but more importantly, a friend of ours.
Yes, she's been on the pod
and
before,
so when I read it, I could
listen to back episodes. She was on years ago.
She was, yeah, and she was the Fennell lecturer here at the university about 18 months ago. And Joanne's a very thoughtful commentator. If you don't follow her on Twitter, you should. So when I read it, sorry, you asked what my initial response was. I read it and I could hear Joanne's voice. It was like chatting with Joanne, which I really enjoy kind of on a personal level. I mean, I think her takeaway is something that I've given a lot of thought to, particularly as we've done this podcast over the past several years now, which is the kind of rationale behind our starting this podcast was to provide some historical context for contemporary events, particularly as the events and the speed of events seem to unfold so rapidly. And we thought it would be a good idea to kind of take time and take stock and reflect on precedents for a lot of these things. One of the things I took away from Joanne's piece is, to a certain extent, I think we as historians are running out of road on that because it does feel at times like, hold on, we haven't been here before. Although Joanne's is a good reminder that we've had bad times before, we've had periods of uncertainty before, and these moments of uncertainty often lead to great change. Now, she cautions us in two ways that I think are really helpful in the piece. One is, she said, look, we don't know how things are going to turn out. And the second point, which she makes, which is also important, is they don't always turn out for the better. She mentions American exceptionalism. There's sort of a Whiggishness built into American exceptionalism, this belief that, you know, although things might be bad for a time, America or the American people usually get things right in the end. And Joanne helpfully and depressingly points out that this is a bit of a conceit, and it's not always so. you know, it's not always onwards and upwards, and we need to be careful. But she also says there are reasons for optimism in the sense that periods of crisis often lead to periods of change, and sometimes those periods of change do yield improvement. So I guess my takeaway is, well, I'm not sure how much of a guide history is. Just the list of events you gave us at the beginning shows us the degree to which this really feels like a unique moment. However, what history teaches us is change and moments of crisis are often accompanied by moments of profound change, but those aren't always for the good. What did you take away from it, David?
I mean, one of the questions that made me think about is, does being a historian, especially being a historian of the United States, does it make living through this particular moment easier, or does it make it more difficult? You know, on the one hand, I think that, you know, the expertise that we have, the knowledge we have about the past, helps us make sense to some degree of some of the events that are happening, although, as you point out, some of the other things that are happening in the past few years have been so outside of the norm of American political history it's hard to sort of wrap our heads around and trying to find antecedents that make sense. You know, on the other hand, I sometimes worry that maybe that our understanding of our study of the past in some ways has made us more anxious about the sort of moment that we're in right now than we need to be. You know, Joanne talks about soul exhaustion that comes from sort of reading the news every day, you know, which I think is something that both of us do. And I think as historians, you know, we tend to be sort of news junkies, as a sort of a professional obligation in some ways. You know, it doesn't necessarily, I'm wondering whether our training actually helps us emotionally sort of cope with and intellectually cope with this particular moment or not. Do you feel that we're better off as a group, Frank, if we were to sort of psychoanalyze historians as a group? Has this been good for us, or has this been made it particularly hard?
Oh, that's an impossible question to answer, because of course we can't speak for other professions, and by definition it's a comparative question. Although that's a classic student move with an exam question, which is when confronted with a question one can't answer to attack the question. I think it is helpful to give us some perspective. I mean, there have been times where I've said, you know, we've had it worse. By we, I mean humanity, and that's important to bear in mind. Although, as I said, there are other days where I'm not so sure that's the case. The other thing that we need to bear in mind for us, David, and by us I mean you and me, is we are American citizens. We were raised in the United States. We are historians of the United States. We don't live in the United States. Yeah. So I think when I think about my colleagues and counterparts who live in the United States in this moment, I think that I often think, ooh, we're lucky to be where we are. We're a step removed from this. I mean, the whole crisis over the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic, which we discussed a few weeks ago and which kind of rumbles on, to some extent reflects the sort of level of, and that's not to say this is not to say that wasn't a significant moment for that organization, but it also reflects the kind of stress and pressure people, our colleagues and counterparts in the United States are under, that I don't think is quite as acute for people outside of the United States, even though people outside of the United States are affected by many of the factors you listed at the outset. You know, we can step out the door and we're not living in Trump's America.
Well, it seems like it's Trump's planet sometimes, but you know,
it's not the same.
No, I think you're right, and you're not 100% right. And you know, I have found the past 3 years particularly sort of emotionally taxing because of all the things that we've been podcasting about. And part of the reason that I've, you know, really enjoyed doing this podcast is have an opportunity to sort of talk through some of these things. to the extent that that's
yeah, this is therapy for
this
you.
This is therapy, for, exactly.
Well, and if people listen, well, that's great. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you. We're not going to pay you the counselor's fee, but anyway, I can imagine how much worse those kinds of levels of anxiety would be, and sort of emotional stress and trauma would be, were I actually to be in the United States. At least here, I have until noon before Trump starts.
It all starts again.
Exactly. I have a few moments, hours of relative quiet, although you got to wake up and find out what happened overnight. Going back to Joanne's article, one of the sort of themes that she sort of tries to draw out is this idea of contingency and how historians think about contingency and how that would shape our understanding of this particular moment. This is, I think, really sort of at the very end of the piece. And that really sort of struck me, because I think one of the things that's I'm trying very hard to figure out now is which of these sort of the many things that are sort of dominating the headlines every day, which of these things is really the critically important ones? Which ones are going to sort of fade into the background? Which of these are actually going to sort of be meaningful in the long run? And that sort of makes me think about sort of the historical process and about sort of the task we do as historians about how to figure out which of the which of the headlines from the past are the ones that are actually going to be relevant, and which are the ones that are not. Looking back, at this particular moment, Frank, which of the stories do you think are going to be the ones that are sort of the prime movers in terms of making sense of where we are right now?
Oh, that's another good question, David. I mean, if I can just, before I answer that, say a word or two about contingency, because I think that's a really important takeaway from Joanne's piece. Yeah. Joanne and I both work on the American Revolution and this, the founding, as it's called, and that very framing, calling it the founding, kind of implies that it was all going to happen, and that it's inevitable. And I think Joanne's piece is a salutary reminder that things, contingency matters, decisions matter. What people do in a moment of crisis determines how a crisis will unfold. And so things are not set in stone. And I think that it's a good reminder of that. And as to your question, so to kind of extrapolate from that, we often get caught up in the day-to-day stuff. And it's hard sometimes. And let's face it, there are day-to-day outrages. Yesterday, the Senate Intelligence Committee, Republican-dominated, released a pretty damning report about Russian interference in the 2016 election. It's hard not to think that's really, really important. The ongoing crisis over the post office that's flared up. It's been going on for a while. We did a podcast on it a couple months ago, but has become particularly acute in the past week or so. Seems really is. On the other hand, if one takes a step back, it seems to me, in answer to your question, the big things that will likely be of historic importance from this moment has to be the pandemic and the economic crisis arising from the pandemic. But politics matters. The political response matters. I say this as somebody who works on, again, I'm using the word advisedly, on the founding. Some people in history want to look at macro causes and events. And we'll say, no, you got to take a step back. You got to take a 30,000 foot perspective on things and see the big picture. Well, if there's one thing we've learned over the past 3.5 years, actually, people in political power making decisions for good or bad actually do have an influence. And so, therefore, if we go back to, in terms of my own period, some people have said, well, why bother studying that anymore? We need to look at things that historians have neglected. I think we do need to look at things historians neglected. But the lessons of the past 3 years, one of the lessons of the past 3 years has been actually what people in political power do is important. And so we can't lose sight of either of those things. But it's a long-winded answer as usual, David. I think the pandemic, the economic crisis are the big picture things that we'll still probably be grappling with 5-10 years from now in terms of consequences. But the day-to-day stuff in aggregate is important too. I'm a total undergraduate in answering these questions.
Oh, no, that's okay. Because
first I questioned the premise of the question the first time, and now I said, yes, it's everything. It's both and.
You are modeling these things for undergraduates, Frank, who are, of course, I don't know whether any undergraduates are listening to the podcast, but, you know, those are both good ways of thinking about how to approach questions that you don't have good answers to, because a lot of these questions are not questions we have good answers to, right?
What do you think, David?
Well, so, I mean, thinking about contingency, one of the, you know, you mentioned sort of contingency in the context of the American Revolution. Thinking about my period, one of the historians who's written a lot about contingency is Ed Ayers, who formerly of the University of Virginia, now at the University of Richmond. One of the founders of Backstory, our one of our favorite podcasts. And when Ayers is written about contingency, one of the things that he's articulated is that there's, you know, there's sort of superficial contingency, like what would have happened if Lee Harvey Oswald had missed, right? And things could have turned out differently. Contingency is based on the idea that things could have turned out differently. And then there's sort of a more deep-seated contingency about how things interact with each other to make more complicated outcomes. And, you know, I think, you know, thinking about all of the events that are taking place right now and how, even if they don't on the surface appear connected, they are really all tied together in complicated ways. So thinking about the pandemic and thinking about the election and the post office and Black Lives Matter and, you know, the sense, like, actually, all these are actually tied together in complicated and non-complicated ways.
Stop, David, stop, stop. I've got to tell you my mental image now because it's really this is therapy for us. It's really important that I tell you exactly what's on my mind.
Okay.
As you say this, I have an image of you now. You know the GIF that goes around?
Yes,
you see, I can never find it. Of the guy, you know, who's looking rather maniacal, who's got the message board behind him with the bits of yarn and the pictures and the headlines, and he's trying to tie everything together in a big theory of everything. That's what you're doing.
Well, I think in some ways, that's what's going on, though. You know, the pandemic is causing, you know, is not unrelated to the kind of Black Lives Matter protests, in part because people couldn't go to work, and so they were able to go and protest in some ways. The questions about the post office and the problems the post office is having is not unconnected to things about the election, which is not unconnected to the economic crisis, which, you know, then there's connections with Trump, and they are tied together in ways that are hard to untangle, you know. And I think part of what we do as historians when we write history or when we teach history is we try to, in some ways, sort of make sense of this complexity and try to, in some ways, simplify the complexity to make it digestible and understandable. And one of the things that Ed Ayers warns about when he writes about contingency is that our tendency sometimes is to try to oversimplify the complexity, to make the sort of causality, you know, and contingency and causality are sort of intertwined together. Make the causality sort of monocausal, and we always that there's a tendency to want to do that. You know, and he points to sort of the Beard's writings about both the revolution and the Beard's writing about the Civil War, and he says, like, one of the problems the Beards may have had is they tended to make more monocausal explanations than the evidence necessarily warrants, and the messiness in which the evidence actually suggests, you know. And I think we're in a really sort of messy place where there is actually a lot of complexity and a lot of contingency at this particular moment. Things could turn out in a very different way than what we expect, given all of these sort of moving pieces on the board. You know, and thinking about where we are in this election cycle, you know, most American elections, the calendar is in some ways kind of predictable and boring, and that's what Americans in some ways like about it. You know, we have these conventions, and they last a certain amount of time, and they look a certain particular way, and then we have the debates, and the debates look a particular way, and then we have, you know, the election night wraps up at a particular time in the evening. And all of those things are, you know, out the window this year. You know, as we've seen, the Democratic convention doesn't look like any convention we've ever seen before. Who knows what the debates are going to look like. You know, election night is not going to look, election day is not going to look like election day usually looks, and election night is not going to look, we think, what election night's going to look like, usually looks like. And so, you know, I think the number of moving parts makes it that much more difficult to make sense and sort of explain how they're working together.
Yeah, I think that's right. I guess if you back to the question of whether historians are well qualified to deal with all this, your initial question to understand what's going around. I mean, you were suggesting finding connections, and that's what we do. We see patterns in the past. We see connections. We don't necessarily have special insight in doing that, except we just spend a lot of time doing it. But you know, I mean, other people have insight as well on these kinds of questions. But sometimes, and I think Ed Ayers does warn us about this, it's often too simple in the sense that we might see connections that aren't necessarily there. Correlation is not always causation, I suppose.
Yeah.
I guess that's the important caveat to what you said. With regard to, a lot of the things we've been talking about, the big picture stuff, what matters, the importance of contingency, impact of the actions and decisions of individuals. I think the really interesting takeaway for historians of the future of this period will be, and we won't know this for a while, is whether Trump and Trumpism is the cause or the symptom. We're much better off if it's the cause and something that, you know, to use kind of Joanne's language about how things might turn out, because that's a problem that might be solved. Whereas if it's a symptom of larger underlying difficulties and problems, it's much more difficult to address and much more difficult to kind of wrap our heads around and comprehend. And really only time will tell about that.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that she, you know, points to in the article is this, you know, this question about sort of when we're going to get back to normal and what normal might look like in the future, if we can even talk about that. You know, I remember sort of the beginning of the pandemic, people said, oh, well, this will be a few months and then we'll be back to normal. And obviously now we're 6 months into this and I'm not quite sure I know what normal is anymore, when normal is going to happen what normal will look like when it does happen.
Oh, I think the world is changing in profound ways, not just the world we inhabit in terms of academia and higher education, although that is being transformed by this pandemic as well. But the world of work, all kinds of things are changing. And again, we won't know that for years to come until this is played out. I mean, I think what it's done is it's exposed weaknesses that were already there. It's accelerated changes that were already underway. But I think it's been a catalytic event as far as really kind of speeding up the pace of those changes and the magnitude of those challenges.
Yeah, it seems sort of like a punctuated equilibrium point, to draw a biological metaphor. You know, one of the things that she also sort of points to is that, you know, we've got all these things that we know are going through moments of crisis right now, whether it's the post office and the pandemic and everything else. One thing that I think that she points to is that there's also the possibility that something that's coming out of left field may arise between now and, let's just say, election day, if that's the next sort of milestone that we're either looking forward to or dreading, depending on one's perspective, that could radically change this sort of calculus of events. You know, there could be an assassination, there could be a terrorist attack, there could be the so-called October surprise, which people sort of worry about in every election cycle. Although it seems like this election cycle, like every month, is a surprise. We've had a January surprise and a February surprise on down. But in some ways, it almost seems that we expect now there to be some kind of unexpected event that takes place in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, ponder this for a second, David. I was thinking about this morning. It was in this year, it was in January of this year, two things happened that have largely been, they haven't been forgotten, but they haven't been, people don't remark on them anymore. The United States killed the kind of security intelligence chief of Iran.
Right.
And that was about a one-day story, at least globally. You know, the Iranians haven't forgotten that. And Trump was impeached.
Yes, that was this year. Yes.
That was this year, and so much has happened since then that it seems like those things happened a lifetime ago. They happened 8 months ago, or within the last eight months.
And one envisions that the next 76 days are going to be even more intensely packed with things that we didn't anticipate would be things.
That's right. I mean, in January, COVID was an issue in China, and some public health professionals were saying, "Oh, we might want to worry about this." But we inhabited a different world in January, and so who knows what will happen in the next 76 days? I guess I'm reinforcing the point Joanne made and that you're making that nearly 3 months is a very long time in 2020.
Yes, it does seem interesting that we sort of think back both to. You know, the period of time you studied, the period of time I studied, that there are moments in which just a huge amount of stuff happens in a very short amount of time, and then, relatively speaking, far less that happens in decades.
Oh, John Adams goes home during his presidency for months and months at a time. And he's like, well, I'm the president, but I can go home. Things were slower. The pace of change and the pace of events was slower in past times. Now, maybe everybody thinks that, but this technology has a lot to do with this. The fact we're all at home and connected right now, as we are at this recording this podcast, has given that sense of urgency and that sense that things are always happening. But 2020 has been remarkable. It's seemingly for just the sheer pace and volume of really significant events. You know, again, since March, and you listed them. You know, we have the pandemic, the economic crisis, and in the United States and now in much of the world, the Black Lives Matter movement, a kind of massive movement for civil rights and against state violence. And that's not even counting things. I mean, we shouldn't be so parochial. I mean, there, you know, we have what's going on in the assaults on human rights and democratic values in Hong Kong and Belarus right now. You want to talk about people who are brave. The yes. Belarusians and the people of Hong Kong are putting it out there every single day. And admittedly, this is an American history podcast and we're Americanists, but there's just a whole lot of stuff going on this year at this moment for whatever reason. It feels like, you know, there are these signal years in history, whether it's 1776 or 1789 or 1861 or 1914. It feels like one of those years.
Yeah. Well, maybe in a century, some historians will come together and write a book series on the global 2020 or something.
That's it. Yeah.
Then thinking about sort of how then dealing with questions about contingency and whatnot, you know, the figuring out how one's going to lecture on 2020 in, I don't know, 2030 or 2040. Yeah, well, we have freshmen in 2040 who didn't live through all this. You know, how does one organize and begin to sort of make sense of these various competing stories, or stories is maybe the wrong word, but competing narratives?
How do you pull together for a survey course? I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, First of all, it's cute that you think there are still going to be lectures in 2040. I like your faith.
Secondly, universities and students, yes, and people.
In 2030, you won't have to worry about it, because if the survey course still exists in 2030 as it does now, we'll never get that. You know, we always aspire to get up to the present, and we never quite make it. So we probably won't make it as far as 2020, no, okay, 2030. But by 2040, we might. I mean, I think you'd have to pick big themes. Now, again, if China has totally surpassed the United States by 2040, and this is, then maybe we look back at 2020 and you say, you know, this was a, you know, the end of the Trump years, the pandemic, the economic crisis, these things all came together in a year of crisis that really signaled the, you know, the beginning of a major downturn for the United States and a rise for China. That's one way you might frame it, depending on how events play out. If, you know, Joe Biden leads a renaissance of the United States and there's a kind of renewal and we begin a new progressive era in 2020 in response to the problems that we've been talking about, then we look at 2020 as a nadir and say, you know, the turning point, the comeback began in 2020. The answer, David, is we don't know. I mean, it's impossible to tell, because we interpret the past in light of what the present looks like, and without knowing what the present will look like in 2040, it's very difficult. In answer to your question of how you reduce this to a lecture,
yeah,
you know, God knows. Thank God we work in different centuries, so exactly. This will be our colleagues Fabian and Robert's problem at that point.
But I think that actually that sort of brings me back to my sort of original question: is you know that we as historians are used to sort of trying to make sense of this complexity and try to articulate it in semi-coherent ways. That's part of our, is the present too close for us to, do the tools that we use as historians, do they work particularly well when dealing with things where we don't know what the outcome is? Because you write about the revolution, you know how the revolution ends more or less. I write about the Civil War. I know how the Civil War ends, more or less, you know, and so I can, you know, but obviously we don't know that right now. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And does that make it understanding the present? Does our training actually hinder us in some ways? And I don't, sometimes I wonder whether it does or not, or whether it makes us more anxious. You know, because it has to have that sort of soul exhaustion that Joanne is talking about. Does that exacerbate it for us?
I don't think so. I think, you know, everybody interprets what's going on in their lives through we use the tools, the analytical tools and the intellectual tools that we have at our disposal and understand. So we're historians, so we're seeing it from a particular perspective. I think if we were epidemiologists, we would have a completely different view. I think, you know, if we were economists or if we were chefs who ran a restaurant and that restaurant was in danger of closing because it has no customers,
yeah,
you know, we would have a very different perspective on this. And so I think people interpret. I don't think we're either helped or hindered in a particular way. I think the tools, the intellectual tools, and the training we have, and the skills we have, and the values we have, help us to interpret what's going on around us from our perspective. Historians try to make sense of the past, or yeah, try to interpret the present by making sense of the past. I guess what's difficult, or the challenges, and I think this was reflected in Joanne's essay, is, and I began by, you know, began this conversation by saying this, is we may be reaching the limits, or it feels like we're reaching the limits of using the tools we have to understand what's going on in the world around us. But maybe, you know, maybe historians felt that in 1919 or in 1941 as well.
Well, that's an interesting question. How does the historical profession deal with the trauma of the new in the past?
I mean, I haven't lost my enthusiasm for history and particularly what the what I study, or a sense of its importance or urgency. Although it's always important to be a little bit humble about that, because most people don't agree with us on that. You know, so in that sense, I haven't felt loss in this particular moment.
It does seem as if actually both of our periods are in the news every day, and maybe it's just because I see them in the news because I'm more attuned to that than most people are, but the number of times in which American history has been referenced throughout this whole year and throughout the Trump presidency, and the ways in which they become relevant in ways that maybe we didn't fully anticipate. You know, it seems like we are as relevant, or at least the past is. I'm not sure about us, but the past seems as relevant today as it ever has been. At least that's how it seems to me.
It does. It does. I mean, again, we shouldn't. I agree with you on that, and our periods in particular seem to be particularly germane at the moment. But you know, we should not necessarily overstate the significance of that. I mean, I've observed the same thing, but I'm not sure what it adds up to.
All right. Thank you, Joyne, for a really sort of thoughtful. And it's for those of you who haven't read it, it's not a very long article, so we highly recommend you go take 5 minutes and read Joanne's piece in the Atlantic.
It's always worth hearing what Joanne has to say.
Yes,
pretty much.
And she's been available on a number of media outlets. She's been doing a Zoom show recently, so that there are lots of ways in which you can interact with her, both in terms of her scholarship and in terms of her public engagement.
Yeah, right. Definitely follow her on Twitter.
Without a doubt.
I mean, one thing that Joanne has said when she was here for the Fennell lecture that's always stuck with me, and we've discussed this, she and I, a couple of times since, is people ask her, is this the worst time in American history, this particular moment? And she said, and obviously she can speak for herself, but as I recollect it, she's got two responses to that. On one hand, she feels like saying, well, yes, it is. On the other, she thinks people are looking for consolation and saying, no, we've had it worse and we've got through it. And so, and either answer is both comforting and discomforting in different ways. And I think that's an interesting way to think about it. But anyway.
Yeah. And of course, better and worse are a matter of perspective.
Of course. And it depends on class and race and your own circumstances and what have you.
To be sure. Right. Last drops time, Frank. What you got?
Well, speaking of historians who are our friends, I want to give a shout out to our colleague Rodri Jeffries Jones. Rodri was my predecessor as professor of American history at the University of Edinburgh. He's now retired, but very, very active. And Rodri is a good friend of ours and a good friend of American history in the UK and in Scotland and even beyond that. And Rodri's just published what I now reckon is his fourth book since he officially retired. He published a book recently called Ring of Spies, and it's about a Nazi spy ring. Rodri's an expert in intelligence history, and he's written very, very important works on the history of the CIA and the FBI over the course of his career. But his most recent book, Ring of Spies, which just came out, is a history of a Nazi spy ring in the United States based in New York in the late 1930s. I have to confess, I haven't read it yet. It's just been published, but it got a very, very nice write-up and a review in this week's Economists. And so I wanted to congratulate Rodri on the publication of his latest book. And if his past work is anything to go by, I can strongly recommend this to you. Based on the review I read, there are some contemporary resonances because clearly the Nazi government of Germany in the 1930s was seeking to infiltrate and indeed influence American politics and subvert American democracy in the 1930s.
Okay. What do you? Rodri's one of my role models for how I want to do my retirement, because he seems to be just as busy and active in retirement as he was when he was teaching.
Yeah, exactly. And he's very witty, Rodri. He's great company. He's a very good friend and good man. And he hired me, in fact. So
okay.
so I owe Rodri a lot.
Great. All right.
What do you have, David?
I just want to recommend two pieces that showed up in the papers recently. One was from the Washington Post. It's an article by Graham Cornwall, which is about Civil War forts in the D.C. area. So during the Civil War, the D.C. was heavily fortified. They were worried about a Confederate attack, which for the most part didn't come. But this guy, who's not a historian of the Civil War, although he is a historian, decides to go and during the pandemic visit all of these forts, and he says there are 68 of them, with his a very small child who was unclear about who exactly was fighting in this war and whether they had, you know, bullets or lasers or stuff. But it's a very fun little piece about how you can sort of find history in your backyard and you know, use the time during the pandemic in an interesting way. And the other piece I want to recommend is by Martha Jones in the New York Times. So yesterday was the anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave white women the right to vote. Ostensibly gave women the right to vote, but because of Jim Crow laws, it was largely white women who got the right to vote. And it's about Martha Jones trying to find out about whether or not her grandmother, who was an African-American woman, whether she was able to vote in 1920 or not. And I won't spoil it for you, but it's a very interesting piece to think about sort of what women's suffrage meant for different segments of the population.
Speaking of women's suffrage, of course, President Trump announced his posthumous pardon of Susan B. Anthony yesterday.
Yeah, which is kind of problematic on all kinds of levels. I mean, first, there's a question about whether he can pardon her because it was a state crime and he can only pardon federal crimes. And she wouldn't have wanted to be pardoned anyway.
Yes, and she's deceased.
And she's deceased. But details. You know, if you want to see like a pardon that means something, like pardon John Brown. Like that's a pardon that might be meaningful. But, you know, pardoning the dead, I guess, is always symbolic. Right.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
Till next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.